Are you familiar with Jennifer Fried's work with her theory of betrayal trauma when it deals with child abuse?
Actually, I wasn't going into all of this here, but the main change in my thinking in terms of how I work with these people clinically over the last 3 years has been shifting much more towards a betrayal trauma type way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not really directly related to mind control, but yeah, I like her theory a lot and I agree with it.
Right.
The false memory people, Jennifer Fried, for listeners who don't know, is the daughter of Pamela and Peter Fried. Pamela Fried is the executive director of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. And the False Memory Syndrome Foundation takes the point of view that multiple personality is pretty bogus, and all these memories that people in therapy are recovering are all false, and it's just a result of basically of mind control techniques by bad therapists. The scientific advisory board of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, which is a whole bunch of academics and experts who advise the foundation and sort of speak on behalf of it, include Martin Orne and Jolly West, who had top secret CIA clearance, Harold Leaf, who is the personal psychiatrist to the Frieds, also was a co-author of Robert Heath, who did the brain electrode research at Tulane that was funded by the various branches of the military and the CIA. And there's about five of Martin Orne's co-authors or people that he thanks in publications of his, going back into the 50s, different mind control research that he did, who are also on the board. Margaret Singer, who interviewed these Korean prisoners of war, who had top secret clearance through the military to do that work, is also on the board. And so there's quite a connection and overlap between these False Memory Syndrome Foundation people, not all of them, but a subgroup of them, and all of this military mind control research.
Have you had any experiences with the False Memory Syndrome Foundation? I understand they have been fairly aggressive in intimidating therapists throughout North America.
Well, I've had a fair bit of experience with the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. I belong to the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. I get their newsletter, and I've been talked about and have written in their newsletter. I set up a workshop in Houston where I spoke for a day and a half, and Pamela Fried, the executive director, spoke for half a day. And I've set up about five or six workshops that I've done with Elizabeth Loftus, who's one of the leading members of the advisory board. I spoke at a meeting that Stephen Cece was at, and he spoke after me, and he commented very favorably on my talk. He's on the advisory board. So I've got a lot of contacts with some of these people, which I consider to be very friendly. I admire their work. I disagree a little bit with some of the things they think, but by and large, I agree with probably over half of what the majority of people on the False Memory Syndrome Advisory Board say. And as I mentioned earlier, I've testified in court basically much the same as any of those people would, that here's an example of really bad therapy that created multiple personality out of nowhere and caused a lot of damage and harm to the person and their family. In the False Memory Syndrome sort of camp, not necessarily the organization itself, but in the kind of camp, there are people who are just real extremists who've gone way overboard, and they're very inflammatory in the way they talk, and everything's all black and white. The whole multiple personality field is supposed to be totally bad, and all the memories are completely false. And so there's people in that camp who go way overboard. My view on them is that if you set aside some of the really political posturing and the most kind of rabid politics that comes out, and you just listen to kind of the basic message, I agree with it, and I think it's been incredibly helpful to the field, not just dissociative disorders field or sexual trauma therapists, but the entire mental health field. Really, in the 1980s, there was almost zero teaching on how error-prone memory is. Almost no teaching at all about how to think about it, what to do about it, what guidelines we need. All these guidelines about false memories and memory not being reliable really have only come out of the professional organization starting in 94. And the False Memory Syndrome Foundation spearheaded that. So a lot of the work they've done has been incredibly helpful. I agree with it. It's simply a fact that memory is very unreliable.
Right.
It's just when you know, things get really polarized and everybody's really insulting everybody else and it's a big war, then it becomes ridiculous.
Well, and it seems that the survivors of abuse are again re-victimized by this type of argument where, you know, the focus seems to be proving whether a memory was false or not instead of actually finding out whether abuse did happen or not.
Well, it gets all politicized, and everybody gets very hot under the collar and very defensive about it. Like in the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, in the membership, I'm sure that there are a whole bunch of people who actually are falsely accused. But I'm sure there's also a whole bunch of people who are accurately accused and are just trying to run a little scam and say it's false memories.
Right.
But that needs to be set aside if you're trying to look at sort of scientifically what are the issues about memory and what's the best way to do therapy and how do you have to kind of balance things to have therapy that's hopefully more beneficial than more harmful. If people would get off all of the ugly politics and have more of a sort of rational, calm, scientific discussion, it'd be much better. And then, then they wouldn't hear the therapist saying that the false memory people are all just pedophiles, and you wouldn't hear the false memory people saying that the therapists are all insane.
Now, in your opinion, how has the false memory debate affected therapy resources available for survivors in a general sense?
Well, it's affected negatively, basically, because a lot of the therapists have got real paranoid. And there's a lot of agitation in the insurance companies and the managed care companies in the United States about this kind of therapy now. The idea that most of the memories are false really is just the basic standard position of psychiatry through the whole 20th century. It's nothing new.
How do you feel that the debate has affected how therapists deal with their clients?
Well, I think it's been beneficial and harmful at the same time. It's been beneficial because therapists have had to kind of get their act together a little bit and be more aware that memory is extremely vague and unreliable and that you can't take everything at face value. And then I've written at great length about strategically how to plan the therapy so that you do the same thing no matter what percentage of the memory is true or false. Most of the time you don't know for a fact. So it's been very helpful in that way. And then it's been harmful in that it's just given an excuse to all kinds of people who don't want to deal with abuse anyway to say, oh, it's all false memories. And it's made the therapist defensive, and it's taken a lot of time and energy away from treatment onto worrying about whether you're going to get sued or not. But you can't. They're sort of opposite sides of the same coin. You can't have therapists finally getting the message that they have to be more careful without also having therapists who are more paranoid about getting sued.
Hmm. For the benefit of other therapists that might be listening, is there a way to recognize signs of possible mind control experimentation? Are there signs that come up again and again in survivor accounts?
You mean actual military or intelligence agency mind control?
Right.
Or because mind control can be done informally and unwittingly by just the pedophile father at home, or it can be done by any one of the known destructive cults, or it can be done as part of a military research program. So it depends which level you're talking about.
I'm speaking, specifically of the government-funded experiments.
No, there's no kind of, if the person comes in with a sore left elbow, that's a sure sign. There's no kind of sign or symptom like that that's going to automatically clue you off. But there's probably going to be some sort of dissociative disorder. And it's not so much that you go after it as the person starts giving you memories of, it wasn't some stereotype satanic thing out in the woods. They start actually telling you something that sounds like medical research of some kind, experiments of some kind. It's either at a university, it's in a hospital, it's on a military base. So I don't think it really is a bad plan to specifically start asking questions. You have to just wait and for the person to start describing that kind of stuff. And then if they start describing that kind of stuff, you just follow normal kind of therapy procedures where you just say, could you tell me a little bit more about that, or I don't quite understand this, or could you clarify that, or what does that mean to you? Why is that important to you? How is that affecting you now? How does that tie into the problems that we're working on now?
Mm-hmm.
So you really just handle it using basic, sensible therapy techniques that you would. There's not a special set of strategies or techniques for mind control as such. And these people basically are human beings who've been hurt and have problems. And you need to use the same basic methods of therapy you would otherwise. So, like, my personal conclusion is that probably the majority, not almost for sure, the vast majority of the satanic ritual abuse memories that I've heard, which involves like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of babies being sacrificed, vast majority of that can't actually be real. Some of it could be. But the techniques that I use and the strategies I use in therapy for people who have those satanic ritual abuse memories are really pretty much identical to the same strategies for somebody who doesn't have those kind of memories. And the same applies to the military mind control people the way I go at it. I use the same basic strategies, principles, and techniques. And I don't really focus on the memories as the main problem.
Mm-hmm. In your opinion, do you think there is any links between the accounts of ritual abuse and mind control experimentation?
Nothing documented. The link is in the mind control experts, the people who are contractors for the CIA and the military, who understand the mind control techniques, therefore the military wants to tap into their expertise, also tend to be people who are experts on mind control techniques of destructive cults. But a direct connection between the cults and the military, the only book I know about that is a book called Was Jonestown a CIA Medical Experiment? Written by a man named Michael Myers,
right.
Published by the Edwin Mellon Press. And he presents a lot of pretty solid documentation that's not quite 100% conclusive that the CIA was heavily involved in Jonestown.
Right, you've gone into a fair bit of detail in your lecture that we've previously aired.
Well, just to give a little smattering of the kind of things. One example is that the People's Temple, which was run by Jim Jones, was based in Ukiah, California, which is north of San Francisco. And then they moved down to the jungle in British Guiana. And before I read this book, I never really thought about how did they go about choosing that site.
Hmm.
Well, it turns out that site in the middle of the jungle in British Guiana, immediately before Jim Jones moved down there, it was the site of the CIA's Shalom Project, which was a program for black, ex-Green Beret military people to train mercenaries for Angola. And then there's a whole, which obviously couldn't just be coincidence, and then there's just a wealth of other detail like that, mm-hmm. connecting all kinds of things in.
In your sense, who do you think is behind all of this?
Well, I think I'm sort of not really that much of a conspiracy theorist. I just think that it boils down to typical normal stuff that controls the rest of the world. So it's got to do with military and the government and banks and helicopter sales and spying. So it's no different from, you know, who runs radar or who runs jets or who runs anything else. A lot of it's just military contracting, and it's the government, and it's the big business. And
mm-hmm.
I don't personally subscribe to a special conspiracy theory like it. And I don't think there's any one, or at least the evidence I see, I don't think there's any one little group of people who meet in some room, you know, somewhere at the Pentagon, who are pulling all the strings on all this. I think it's much like the federal government. It's all kinds of little groups working at cross purposes, and there's no one grand master design of any kind.
Right. Instead, network, the old boys network.
Yeah, the old boys network is the way I describe it. And that's one reason I think of that is there doesn't have to be some kind of huge. Obviously, there is a conspiracy in a sense in that there's secret funding of mind control research, and there's files, and it's kept from the public. But in terms of the stuff that actually documented, there didn't have to be that huge a conspiracy because they just went ahead and published it in the medical literature anyway. The conspiracy is really the sort of old boys network, everybody just looks the other way and knows that they're not supposed to comment on it kind of conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that anybody has to, you know, send out a memo to every psychiatrist in North America saying, keep this secret. Everybody just kind of looks the other way, steers around it, doesn't rock the boat, doesn't make waves.
I've just got a couple more questions. I'm wondering how a person undergoes the healing process that have been traumatized as a child or having participated in the mind control experimentation, what is the process for healing?
Well, some people are probably too damaged to be able to heal. So nobody should claim that they know how to help everybody. Or some people are damaged and they have the ability to heal, but I'm just not going to be able to describe how that should be done. So they need to go to somebody else. But the people that we work with, multiple personality, who all describe really traumatic childhoods, we don't really, like I mentioned just a few minutes ago, we don't really focus on the memories as such. Mm-hmm. What we deal with is how these different personalities working together as a sort of inner family are getting along with each other, and mostly not getting along with each other. And we try and get them to have more open communication and cooperation with each other, have more of a problem-solving, strategizing kind of approach to life instead of all this conflict and fighting and amnesia. And then we work on building up more healthy, more flexible ways of coping with life. And that's just in a nutshell. To describe in detail, that's why my book is 400 pages long.
Right. It
takes quite a while.
And you had mentioned that a lot of, in a particular test that you've done, a lot were able to integrate these personalities back into a kind of a whole. Is that really the goal of the healing process, or?
Well, it's the goal in one sense to be. We're just talking about people with multiple personality. The
right.
vast majority of people who are involved in mind control experiments, or in the vast majority of people who are abused as children, don't have multiple personality. I just specialize in that little subgroup, which is only a little, you know, small island in this whole sea of trauma. But the reason integration is a goal for them is basically that it's normal and desirable to be sort of an integrated human being. Mm. And if you have a reasonably healthy, happy childhood and adolescence, and you have a reasonably healthy, happy, normal adulthood, you're going to be integrated. You're not going to have multiple personality. But the other reason is because it just works better. It's not that integration is the big goal in and of itself. It's just that integration is a way to get to the goal of far, 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 far less symptoms, much more happy, settled state internally, much better quality of personal relationships, much better functioning in the workplace, and huge reduction in the amount of healthcare and mental healthcare resources you need.
Now, you mentioned that you are about to release a book about mind control. What specifically will the book deal with, and when will it? Do you expect it to be published?
Well, I just finished the second draft of the third draft of the book, so it's been through three complete changes, and now the final one. I've done a pretty extensive rewrite of it. And I've got a little bit more information. I'm just sort of digesting and waiting to come in from one of the universities that I got some information from. And then I'll probably go over it one more time kind of stylistically, and then we'll see if we can get a publisher to bite on it. So I'm hoping that it'll be out before the end of 97.
Mm-hmm. And what specifically are you dealing with in the book?
Basically everything that we've been talking about. The main points are going to be that the U.S. military and the CIA have been creating experimental multiple personality, and that's an established fact because of the documentation. The extent that those people were used in operations is still not really fully known. The fact that you can create artificial multiple personality, to me, proves both that, like I said earlier, that it can be created artificially and also that it's likely to arise spontaneously, and I go into that in a bunch of detail. And then all this other crazy mind control research, I use that to set the context to make it believable that multiple personality could have been created by the military. Because if you just hear that out of nowhere, it just seems too much to believe. But when you have that whole context, then you realize really it just fits in nicely. And then the other part is to try and stimulate either a presidential commission or some sort of public inquiry into this and get the medical ethics of it really tightened up and make sure that this stuff is not ongoing.
Right.
And get some recognition and compensation for the victims. That's basically the gist of the book.
Do you have evidence of experimental brain implant surgery being done on epilepsy patients?
Well, there's two answers to that question. One is that all this documented brain electrode implant research that I described some of those patients actually had epilepsy, and a whole bunch of them, epilepsy was kind of a phony rationale for putting the electrodes in. So when you read that literature, a lot of the time they'll describe the patient as having epilepsy. And then other times they actually put brain electrodes in just for either psychiatric reasons, which were basically bogus reasons, or purely experimental reasons. But epilepsy is one of the rationales for putting brain electrodes in. That's totally documented.
And would these people be informed of that they were to receive brain implants? Or?
Yeah, but the sort of explanation for why that was scientifically justified and the informed consent procedure was really iffy.
Yeah. And what literature is available on this subject?
There's a book called Violence in the Brain by Mark and Sweet, published, if I remember the year, like 1970 or 72. It's a little bit hard to get. Or if you go into... part of the problem is you can't do computerized searches of the medical literature before 1966. But if you go to the medical literature in the period 1955 to 1970, and you look for publications by Robert Heath at Tulane University or Jose Delgado at Yale, you'll find those scattered around in the medical literature.
Okay.
Or you just do literature searches on brain electrode implants. Or then there's a huge literature on LSD. So it's just a matter of really going to the library and searching around.
Right.
Or in the book, like I'll reference a lot of it.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much, Dr. Colin Ross, for joining us on CKLN. It's been very illuminating talking to you, and I wish you all the best with your new book.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for doing a series on this.
We've been listening to an interview with Dr. Colin Ross, a Canadian psychiatrist working with dissociative identity disorder, and has also documented the CIA military mind control experimental programs. Transcripts are available of the lecture that started off this series at the office of CKLN for $2. And the transcripts of this interview will be available in 2 to 3 weeks' time at CKLN. We'll be back next week with more in the Mind Control in Canada radio series on the International Connection here on 88.1 CKLN. Thank you.